Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Hi there, thanks for joining us. And if you've ever doubted the connection between religion and politics, you need to be in the USA today, where in many states it's the last day of pre-poll voting. And in African American communities, local churches have been busy getting souls to the polls. Yes, pre-polling has been proved pivotal in the last three presidential elections, and no one, it seems, is taking anything for granted. And today, Sunday, is the big get-out-the-vote day. According to CNN, the Democrat organisation on the ground includes precinct-by-precinct phone calls to voters, encouraging them to pre-poll. Then, if they don't, getting a neighbour to drop by and issue a little encouragement. And if that fails, in African-American areas, getting a call from the local pastor. That's taking your faith seriously. Churches in Australia, while not so directly political, do see it as critical to their role in society to have a view on social issues, particularly welfare. And such was the case this week with the release by Anglicare, the welfare arm of the Anglican Church, of their annual State of the Family report, this year titled Positions Vacant, When the Jobs Aren't There. In a few moments, we'll be joined by a panel to take a look at the report and what it's saying about contemporary Australia. But to strike the note first, to this year's Nobel laureate, Bob Dylan.
Well, he burned my barn and he stole my horse. I can't say but die. I've got to be careful. I don't want to be forced into a life of continual crime. I got a brand new suit and a brand new wife. I can live on rice and beans. Some people never work a day in their life. Don't know what work even means. Well, meet me at the bottom, don't lag behind. Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working bands.
Bob Dylan, Nobel laureate. Bit difficult to conceive of still, even after a couple of weeks. Working man's blues. And underlying much of the debate in this week's presidential election is the story of the loss of jobs in the American manufacturing heartland. Well, to discuss Australia, the working or not working world and the future, it's a pleasure to welcome the CEO of Anglicare Australia, Casey Chambers. And Anglicare issued the report this week, Positions Vacant, When the Jobs Aren't There. Casey, welcome to you.
Good evening, thank you. And what a privilege to follow the Nobel laureate.
Yes, indeed it is. We're all getting used to that. It's also great to have with us the director of the St. Vincent de Paul Society, Dr. John Falzon. John?
G'day, John. How are you? Hi, Casey.
And also the workplace editor for Fairfax Media, Anna Patty. Anna, thanks for joining us. This is the first time you've been with us here on Sunday night.
It's a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you.
Well, Casey, work for all is something we'd all aspire to. But given Donald Trump and Brexit, your report, with its emphasis on the lack of work for all, seems to have some global resonance, if not prescience. Did you plan it for such a time of this?
We probably couldn't have planned it better, could we, in some ways. But I think, you know, it is a story that's worth telling at any time, and thank you for spotlighting it for us. But, look, we had been talking for some time. You know, a lot of people are talking about those figures, 732,000 people unemployed in Australia, and we know that to be unemployed, you know, you basically just have not to have worked for more than an hour in the last fortnight. So it's a, you know, a very, you can be employed very easily in that way. And about 167,000 jobs on average. So we know those kind of figures. But we wanted to, I guess, drill down into that a little bit and look at what it actually meant for the kind of people that Anglicare works for and with. And so what we were looking at was people who might have some extra barriers to the workforce, people who might not have finished year 10, perhaps young people leaving care who've had their education disrupted, people who finished school before it seemed important to do Year 10. Basically, people with more barriers to the general workforce. So the Australian government very, very helpfully breaks down all the positions vacant into different levels. And just to give listeners an idea, a level one would be a CEO, it would be a GP, a doctor, a surgeon. Basically, it requires a postgraduate, you know, secondary degree and years of experience. And we go down or through to a level five. Now, a level five job is one that would require level 10 or its equivalent. So that's, we looked at the level five jobs. We looked at the number that were available in a certain month this year. And then we looked at job seekers who might have some extra barriers to work, again, as classified by the federal government. What we actually found was really quite shocking, and that was that for every level five job or entry level job, there were 6.3 people who were classified by the government as having extra needs in terms of getting into employment. Now, 6.3 of those people to every one job, it doesn't mean they're the only ones applying for them either. So everyone's competing for those jobs. So very, very difficult. In some states and territories, it was even harder. Tasmania, we see 10.6 people for every job. South Australia, for example, were at the level of 9.4 there. So really, really difficult sort of stats to be facing there if you're somebody who might not yet have qualifications or experience. Particularly difficult for young people, you know, entering the workplace. If you haven't got a job, you can't get experience, and you can't get a job if you haven't got experience. The other thing that we found, which is alarming, and I think behind some of your introduction, John, about the global changes to the workforce, was that over the 10 years that the Australian government's been categorising the job vacancies, over those 10 years, the number of level five, or those we're calling them entry level positions, the proportion of them has dropped. So in 2006, you could have expected over 21% of all vacancies to have been advertised at that level. In 2016, we're looking at 13%. So we've really got to start thinking about our training, about our education systems. The other message we think in this for us is that, you know, we firmly, firmly believe that a job is fantastic for people. You know, it gives dignity, it gives identity, it gives income. It's the best form of welfare there is. It really is. But what this report shows is that the reason people aren't getting jobs is not because the dole is too lucrative, but because the jobs aren't there. And so our report that backs onto this research is about what we can actually be doing, what Anglicare services are doing, and services that, you know, Vinnies would have and other organisations around helping people bridge that gap between where they are now and getting jobs. And not just getting that entry-level job, but actually continuing to train and grow and scaffold into the next level of job, because we can see that entry-level is disappearing.
Casey, the report goes a lot further too. Because it's in a series of essays, the report goes a lot further than just the summary of statistics that you've given us. It gives us some personal insight into the sorts of people who are looking for jobs and the sorts of stresses they find themselves in. And it gets particularly harsh when you look at areas like the car industry and the collapse there. And you're seeing sort of Ford going, seeing General Motors going, and people getting put into training programs and the government offering money for training programs. But after a time, albeit 2 or 3 years, it seems that those people are still, many of them, where they were when they walked out of the gate. Because, as you say, the jobs aren't there. Mm-hmm. It's not a matter of fitting workers for the jobs. It's the jobs aren't there.
That's right. And one of the things that we see as well is that a lot of those training courses, they're one-size-fits-all kind of things. They go out and get this training course and this, that and the other. What we actually see that works is when a training course is fitted to what the person's strengths are, what they want to do, and the work that's available in their area. So it's a kind of line of sight to the next job. One of our members, the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, they looked at a lot of people they were working with who'd been unemployed for a long time. 41% of those people had done recent training courses, but they're meaningless. If they're not actually linked to something that those people can do and want to do, then it's pretty meaningless and pretty hopeless to be churned through these kind of training programs. And the programs that we look at that actually work are programs that sit alongside people, work with people. You know, we've got programs where we look at why people aren't working, and you might not set out that day to get someone a job, but you might say, okay, you've lost your driving license because you have got some unpaid fines. You haven't been able to pay the fines because your rent is unsustainable. So let's start working on those kind of things. And maybe, you know, in 3 months we have a driving license and then we can get a job. But it's understanding where people are now to actually go that next step.
John Falzon, a few weeks ago, I saw you on Late Line making some of the very points that Casey and her Anglicare report are making, that the focus has been for a long time on the individual and their responsibility to get off welfare, get onto a job. But you were making the point then too that we've got to actually look at this a different way, that in fact it's the availability of jobs, not the skills of the people, that we've got the major mismatch in.
Yes, and one would have to assume that this is a deliberate lie. Instead of focusing on the reality, which is a failure of the labour market, we have government rhetoric, tired old rhetoric, being wheeled out to suggest that this is a failure of the individual. Nothing could be further from the truth, as Casey has just illustrated with that data. We know very well that you can apply all the sticks in the world to the backs of those who are struggling on the edges of the labour market, but that won't help a single person into a job if the job is not there. We've seen manufacturing jobs disappearing in Australia. We've seen the loss of jobs in a number of sectors due to privatisation. We've seen the global quest for ever greater profits by using ever cheaper labour. We've seen this very worrying trend towards casualisation and insecure employment. And the latest ABS labour force figures show an overall decline in the total number of monthly hours worked in all jobs. We've got some very, very clear indicators about the structural drivers of unemployment and underemployment. And what do we see as a response? We see a government saying the problem lies with the individual rather than actually looking at real solutions. It's sort of like saying, the problem is with, by blaming the so-called welfare system, it's sort of like blaming hospitals for people being sick and saying, well, you know, our goal is to get people out of hospital rather than our goal is to make sure that people enjoy happy and healthy lives. Well, that's exactly what we're seeing played out in Australian politics today. And frankly, we are tired of this. We in the charitable sector who are being left to pick up the pieces and being, we are in effect we're the de facto providers of social security because people are already being forced to live below the poverty line. And yet the government is saying that they begrudge these meagre means for survival and that these people who've been locked out of the prosperity are to blame and they're costing the rest of us too much. I mean, give us a break.
Anna Patty, you're the workplace editor for Fairfax newspapers, the Sydney Morning Herald in Sydney and others around the nation. This question of the way the debate is being framed, there does seem to have been a lot of, for the casual observer, a lot of emphasis on getting people ready for jobs. The question that John Falzon raises about the structural drivers on the other side, that is the changing nature of the workplace. There seems to be plenty of discussion about it, but not what the direct linkage is to the question of availability of jobs. Is that a failure of journalism or a failure of basically the way the debate is being framed?
I think there's a real policy vacuum in addressing these issues. I went to a recent breakfast where Michaela Cash, the employment minister, was basically saying that in 15 years' time, 40% of existing jobs will be automated. And she said Australia needs to embrace things like the way Airbnb and Uber do business. This is the future of work. This is part of the whole jobs and growth slogan that the government's spouting. But there's not a lot of detail on how we get there and how we adjust to this new future of work. Michaela said things like whether we like it or not, and sometimes these things can be a little bit scary, but when you travel overseas, other countries like China are embracing the future of work, like Uber, and if we were to remain globally competitive as an economy, it's not a choice for us. We have to ensure our systems and our regulation responds appropriately. To do this, we're going to have to look at structural and cultural reform. She doesn't explain what that all means, but she does say that in relation to our workplace relations system, that needs reform. But again, there was a little detail. So I think, again, it is about the person looking for work having to pick up the slack. I don't think the government hasn't spoken a lot about how we're going to create these jobs and where the growth will be.
There seems to be a problem in a number of debates in the country we're having at the moment, Anna, about this gap in the middle between where one group are, where the problems are, and how you get from one side of the chasm to the other. And the word that bridges the chasm is reform. But nobody actually spells out what reform means. For some, reform means less taxes. For others, it means more jobs or more welfare. That what reform means seems to be at the centre of the problem, really, in terms of public debate.
Yeah, I think there's a real absence of, you know, this explaining how this all works. And we've heard a lot about the need for more regulation, and I think businesses can look forward to penalty rates being cut. Not that, you know, a lot of them actually pay them when it comes to workers on 457 visas, but anyway, that's another story. There's not a lot of talk about how we're going to get people who have worked for these industries that don't exist anymore, how we get them into the workforce, how we get them into training. And the Work for the Dole scheme has holes all the way through it. People complain that they're trained in areas that are completely irrelevant to their areas of interest and expertise. They're being pushed into jobs that they're you know, like traffic controlling jobs or, you know, holding up stop-go signs when they'd been working as accountants. It's this kind of thing. And there's also a lot of rorting in that industry too, where the Work for the Dole programs aren't actually providing the training that they're supposed to be training. So these people are being left in the lurch.
Casey, are we there getting, with Anna's example, an example of skewed policy as well? That is, bureaucrats, as you've pointed out, have had access to this data for years, yet the policy analysis or prescription seems to come up with programs like some of those Anna has given us. But we're still seeing kids coming out at the equivalent, as you say, of 10th grade with no possibility, reasonable possibility, of finding work. The whole debate is in fact completely skewed.
Yeah, I mean, I think firstly, in response to some of the comments that have gone before, there's just this sense to me that in talking about it in the way that puts all the responsibility onto the individual, and this is really one of the kernels of our report, what it allows people to do, it allows all of us to blame that unemployed person so we can set them up as the other, as different to ourselves, and we can walk away. And I say that now because I know we want to come back to religion and politics later. But certainly, I think when we look at the changes that have happened over the last 10 years in the job market, one of the things that hit me when we first got this data was that it's not really time. It's changing so quickly that it's not time for a child who's picking their subjects, their direction today, to know where it's going to be in 10 years' time. And certainly anyone coming out without year 10, you know, it's going to be a very difficult situation for them. The other thing that we found, of course, is when we look at these, many of the job adverts are actually overstating things. So they are calling for greater qualifications and experience than they actually need, because they can, because at the moment we have an oversupply of people and an undersupply of jobs. So there's also that sense that we're, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, you might have got a go at something. You're not going to get that go now. You know, we have shifted up in those kind of politics. And since we've been talking about this report, this is slightly off the subject of your question, but since we've been talking about this, I've had people contacting me. Somebody who contacted me is a tradie on the New South Wales South Coast, and he was telling me that over the last couple of years, he's been approached about half a dozen times by parents who have asked him to take their young person on, their teenager, and they will pay the wages if he will simply do an apprenticeship with them, because they know that that's the only way that they're child, their teenager, is going to get a job. They're actually willing to buy a job.
It's an extraordinary situation to find ourselves in, John Fowlson. You've raised this issue, as we indicated in my first question to you. What's your analysis of it? I mentioned to Casey that is this a failure of the bureaucracy, or is it a failure of both sides of politics, that the Labor Party haven't really grasped this foundationally yet either?
Both sides of politics have consistently refused to raise the level of unemployment benefits. So, you know, we haven't seen an increase in real terms since 1994. Now, that is a disgrace, to deliberately keep those benefits low, as if we need, as a society, to further humiliate people for being excluded from the labour market. So that's point number one. Point number two is we are at the moment seeing a ramping up of inequality. We don't have a problem with welfare. We have a problem with inequality. But what is the government's answer? Let's take the fact that, you know, we're seeing around 731,300 children under the age of 15. Who are living below the poverty line. What's the government's response? Oh, we better cut the family payments. We better punish the parents, particularly sole parents. I mean, this is a sickening trend. And our analysis is quite simple. This is a deliberate attempt to avoid the responsibility that government has to do what markets cannot. So we saw the microeconomic reforms of the 1980s that delivered benefits to some, but also severe disadvantages to others. Government instigated those microeconomic reforms with a guarantee that it would put in a kind of social contract so that people would be protected from some of the losses that came about. We have seen a withering away of those protections, and now we are seeing a concerted effort not only to strip away some of the protections from our social security system by demonising the very system, not just the people, but demonising the system, but then moving into that low end of the labour market and punishing people who are low paid, so that you know, as Anna referred to this proposal, that we strip away some of the penalty rates, that we undermine the minimum wage, particularly through absolutely scandalous and nonsensical schemes such as the PATH internship program, which you know, is actually going to take away real jobs rather than provide them. So we're seeing quite a concerted effort on those two fronts of dismantling Social Security, not just the cash transfers, but the non-cash transfers through housing, education and health, and at the same time trying to deregulate the labour market to make it even harder for people who at the moment are struggling in some cases around the poverty line, even though they are in paid work.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. This evening, we're talking about the State of the Family report published by Anglicare Australia last week, positions vacant when the jobs aren't there. Our guests in the studio are the CEO of Anglicare, Casey Chambers, John Falzon of St Vincent de Paul, and Anna Patti. From Fairfax, the Sydney Morning Herald. Anna, we spoke a little about some of the overall observations with you earlier. The government, a couple of months ago, released this idea that it was going to have a new look at welfare, and particularly going to use an approach that had been tried out in New Zealand, an actuarial approach to welfare. That is, a deep analysis of the statistics, but as yet it seems something that's a little untested in the employment market. One or two articles only in the press, one or two statements by the ministers, but no evidence yet that we've begun to sort of adopt this actuarial approach, this fine analysis approach that the government is talking about.
No, and there was an interesting point in the Anglicare report which pointed out that the government has criticised social welfare groups for being unimaginative, for suggesting that the welfare payments need to be lifted above the poverty line. And I thought it was a nice response that Anglicare gave to that point, where they said it requires only a little imagination, however, to see how destructive and unhelpful it is socially and economically for government to ignore the consequences of such endemic poverty and to refuse to accept any responsibility for it and the structural exclusion it reflects. And I'm also thinking about John's comments about and his frustration about having to pick up the slack for the government not increasing social welfare above the poverty line. The only real sense I got of programs that were actually working were the not-for-profit sector and organisations such as his, and the Brotherhood of St Lawrence were... I spoke to some people who'd been involved in a program where the Brotherhood of St Lawrence was partnering with nursing homes, for instance, and they were getting people who'd been long-term unemployed. One example I looked at was a refugee guy in Melbourne, and they gave him some work experience for about 6 months, and it was very targeted, and he ended up getting a full-time job at a nursing home. There were some kids in Sydney that I spoke to who were partnering with or who were working with Anglicare. They were getting relevant on-the-job training in IT in a call centre, and that was leading them directly into a job. I've spoken to lots of people on the Work for the Dole scheme who are just working in areas that are completely irrelevant to where they want to work or in terms of helping them get a job. And I just think, yeah, John is right in that they are picking up a lot of slack.
Our guests, Casey Chambers of Anglicare, John Falzon of St Vincent de Paul, and Anna Patti, workplace editor for Fairfax and the Sydney Morning Herald. Casey Chambers and John Falzon, have you, either of you, heard about this new actuarial approach to welfare and got some handle on what it is? I understand that in New Zealand it's mixed blessings territory. John first.
What we know of the New Zealand experience, and We can't assume that that is going to be replicated in Australia, but we have seen, obviously, evidence of some people benefiting from targeted support. Overall, we've seen a cut of around $3 billion from the Social Security budget. One of our colleagues in New Zealand is on the record as saying, well, it's actually harder to get on or to stay on a benefit, but there are no new jobs to go to. So once again, we're seeing a complete systemic blindness, avoidance of the structural causes of unemployment. And to dress this up as investment when we are predicating the approach on an overall net divestment, again, is disingenuous. And we actually do want to see an investment in people. We believe that you don't build people up by putting them down. And sadly, along with the announcement of this so-called priority investment approach, has gone all of this rhetoric of blaming people and saying, well, the problem lies in the fact that our social security system is far too generous, and if only it wasn't, people would have a job. And then this is so heartbreaking to see, for instance, young carers being shamed for allegedly how much they are going to cost the taxpayer in a lifetime. I mean, if only the government were as keen on calculating the human cost of inequality and homelessness and exclusion as it was on calculating the so-called cost burden of supporting people who are struggling.
What is it? Seven changes of job in a lifetime? Casey, I think I wouldn't mind seven changes of job in a lifetime so long as I had a guaranteed level of employment of salary which would cover me through those periods of gross unemployment while I was looking for the next one in that chain of seven jobs. Seems to be a lot of untested assumptions in the sort of world we're being offered.
I think there is, and I think that's where we've got to turn our attention. This whole future of work thing and the disruption. Since we put our report out, we've seen the announcement of the closure of the Hazelwood power plant. Now, on the one hand, yes, we've got to get out of coal, we've got to get out of environmentally destructive industries, but we need to find a way, and we're a rich enough country to do it, we're a rich enough community, world community to do it, to find a way in which we disrupt and change without harming anybody. And there does seem to be, to me at least, it seems to be a choice. We can either harm somebody or we need not. We don't. I'm sitting here listening to the conversation and taking part in it, obviously. But, we're talking about 1.6 million people in Australia being unemployed or underemployed. John mentioned the report out recently about, nearly 750,000 children in poverty. And you sort of think, is this Australia? Where are we talking about here? So, yeah, I think we've got to actually start thinking about what does work look like. And if there isn't enough work to go around for the whole of your career, then let's stop talking about a punitive dole. And it is punitive. It is making an assumption that you are unemployed because you're wrong and because you are to blame. And let's start looking at these minimum incomes that, several other countries are looking at, so that while people are actually between jobs, they're not going backwards, they're not being harmed. And certainly different research of ours that we did with NATSEM shows that people who are on Newstart spend 122% of their income. Now, that sounds a bit odd, but what it means is that they are spending more than they've got, because you can't actually live on Newstart. So what they're doing is they're pawning things, they're making choices not to insure a car or to let a car go. They are actually making choices not to eat on, up to a day, a fortnight. They're pawning things, they're getting into unsustainable loan situations. So we know that people are actually harmed by being on Newstart. Now, that's not a new start for a new job. So, yeah, I think we should broaden ourselves to be thinking about this minimum income. So while you change between those seven jobs, and that would be kind of exciting, you've got something that will hold your place in the world and hold your head above water in the meantime.
but there's a couple of other topics we can raise in the meantime, and that is one of those issues is the way in which we seem not to be wanting to grasp a problem that's now emerging around the world and is something that is affecting politics around the world. It seems that our political processes, whether they're in Britain, the United States, or Australia, seem incapable of moving away from a philosophy that's been fed to the public for about 40 years. That is, that the way to have a rapidly rising economy that raises all boats is to drop the ballast, to get rid of taxes. Taxes are the ballast, and taxes aren't productive for the economy. We've got a new wave of economists, Thomas Piketty and others, seem to be saying, well, actually, the evidence isn't quite that. Yet nobody seems to be taking this on board yet in a policy sense. Are you getting, Anna, any sense that the debate is beginning to shift among the politicians, that they're willing to talk about, perhaps the tax mix needs to be altered rather than just this blanket, we've got to get taxes lower?
I haven't heard a lot of discussion about that, but I went to a recent dinner where the unions are certainly starting to talk about this. And Sharon Burrow, who's the head of the International Labour Organization, really focused on that very issue at a dinner in Sydney the other week. And she was basically describing the global economy as broken. And she really focused on the high proportion of people who are now are outside the formal economy, I guess, that she's saying 50% of people now are in insecure work and on short-term contracts and unsafe work, and a lot of workers within this system are being exploited, and she's throwing a challenge out to people to address this issue because it is becoming a bigger problem.
John Falzon.
What we're seeing at the same time as government is saying we need to cut social expenditure, it's saying we need to cut corporate tax rates and cut the tax rates for high wealth individuals. It's a perverted application of the biblical saying, to those who have much more will be given, and from those who have little, even the little they have will be taken away. This is a blatant ramping up of inequality. It's a redistribution of wealth, of social wealth, away from the majority and towards an ever wealthier minority, an elite. And at the same time, we are seeing not only the construction of walls to lock people out, not only of jobs, but of housing, of education, of out of health. We're seeing not only the building of the walls, but making a profit out of building the walls. So people are being locked out, by these walls. And then, as a society, we have the audacity to say, well, they lack the aspiration to scale the walls. And then you have the community sector being given the everyday task of helping people one at a time over those walls, to scale those walls. But our long-term mission has to be to tear those walls down, not to allow those walls to stay, because, and then, of course, the long-term result of people being locked out, being locked up, follows hot on the heels of being locked out, and so incarceration, again for profit in many cases, if we follow the American path, becomes the end game, of this ramping up of inequality, this increase in homelessness. I mean, we've just seen the government refusing to commit to continue funding the National Partnership Agreement on homelessness. We're going to, if we don't invest not only in homelessness services but in housing and in social security for people who are unable to access a job, homelessness won't just be caused by government policy. Homelessness will be government policy.
Casey Chambers, looking at the Anglicare report, There are stories of hope in the report. Some people offer stories of hope. But in the broad policy prescription area, when it comes down to the sort of baseline stuff, if you were making three or four major recommendations to government, what are you saying?
Okay. We would say increase Newstart now, because, you know, it's proven that it's not a lucrative lifestyle choice. It's a fact that the jobs aren't there. We would say let's look at some real job creation. There are many, many jobs that are currently not done that would benefit our community and our environment if they were done. So let's get on with doing them, give people the dignity of that work. We'd also say let's have a real look at what it actually means to be a 21st century economy. And you know, this whole thing, the disruption, the let's get innovative, all these kind of things, I have a sense that that particular emperor might not be wearing quite as many new clothes as we think he is. I don't know, you know, I've got a very simple view on life. So I think we need to actually face up to that. And we need to face up to the fact that on the one hand, if we're saying there's disruption and there's new things coming, we can't keep on doing things the old way. I think one of the things I took from Anna's comments about the breakfast she attended recently is we do seem to be saying that. We seem to be having yesterday's answers to tomorrow's problems. So I think those would be our three. Increase Newstart, or let's get rid of it. Let's just start a minimum income for people. Let's look at job creation that will actually do us some good community and environmental projects. Let's get on with them, and let's actually really all face up to whether the emperor is wearing new clothes or not, what colour they are, how many he's wearing, and what we should do if he's naked.
Anna, the government doesn't seem to be departing from its rhetoric, though, that what we need is lower taxes and incentives for business and a few more sticks for the unemployed in the welfare system. And Scott Morrison just a few weeks ago coined the term the taxed and the taxed knots. Behind the scenes, do you get a sense that there is real thinking? You quoted Michaela Cash earlier as giving a line which didn't seem to recognise that there was a gulf between the opportunities and the issues. Is there any sign that underneath this, that wheels are beginning to turn?
Look, I'd hope so. they haven't told me what's happening behind the scenes. I only get what they're prepared to say publicly, and there's just not a lot of flesh on the bones of what they're saying publicly. I mean, you would hope that they're working hard on this behind the scenes, but there's just not a lot of evidence that they've got solutions to these problems. There are a lot of slogans. It's all about jobs and growth. It's all about innovation. It's all about agility. But how? How are we doing that?
John Falzon, if that's the case, are we really looking here at what's ultimately a moral question? It's a question about the nature of the good society and what we owe to each other as citizens in a civil society, the social contract, if you like to put it in secular terms.
We all suffer when inequality is ramped up. We all suffer economically. We all suffer socially. We all suffer the human cost of rising inequality. And that is manifested in a number of ways, such as in increased levels of health problems, including mental health problems. So, you know, whether you want to use the language of morality, which in some ways I am hesitant to do, because sadly that is precisely the discourse that the government is engaging in, a moralising discourse in order to put the boot into people who have suffered the brunt of inequality. It's precisely this very old moralising discourse that they are lacking in virtue, that they are given to vice, that they are lazy, that they are lacking in aspiration, that they are not good people. So we either pathologise or indeed criminalise people for the fact that they are bearing that brunt of economic inequality. I would say that if we actually do want a good society, one where nobody is missing out on those essentials of life, a place to live, a place to call home, a place where we feel safe, you know, a place from which we can love and be loved, a job, And for those who are unable to work an adequate income, so that they're not forced to live below the poverty line, so that they're not forced to rely on charity when all they want is justice, a place to learn. Talk about an investment approach. Gonski's an investment approach, and the government has walked away from that. TAFE, a national treasure, that's an investment approach, and we've seen that undermined completely. We need to invest strongly in education from early childhood, school, TAFE, university, all of it. And a place to heal, of course. So place to live, place to work, place to learn and place to heal. No one should be locked out of those things. Now, that, in essence, is a good society that we all feel a sense of dignity to belong to.
Katie Chambers, is there any evidence in the reception to your report that bureaucrats are listening to what you're saying, even if the politicians aren't able to articulate that yet, either for political reasons or other reasons?
I've had a chance to meet with a couple of bureaucrats over the report. I have to say people are surprised on the whole, which, is interesting because they are, the data that we bring together in the research is federal government data, but I think it was sort of the first time it had been put together in this particular manner. The other thing is that if we get a bit optimistic towards the end of this hour and we think about some of the government is looking at some different approaches. They've got a programme out called Try, Test and Learn. There were meetings of people brought together to consult on that. Interestingly, they're a bit secretive, these meetings, and it took Senate estimates to find out who had actually attended and been invited. But, there are some ideas of how things work. This is the thing, this isn't rocket science. We actually do know what works. And our report is not just an unimaginative critique of the unemployment data. The report that we've put around that is some ideas about what it looks like when people get out of prison, what it looks like for young people leaving care, what it might look like in those states that are restructuring, like South Australia and WA, that's had a very sharp shock. We've had some meetings. I've had a lot of people contact me that this has hit a real nerve. And one of the ones that I liked the best was someone who contacted me who just got back from a holiday in Japan. And what they were saying was, there would be three or four people in a cafe working, people to welcome them. On public transport, there were people there. I caught a train from Sydney on Thursday. I was in a central station. There was one ticket machine, and the person in front of me couldn't work their card in it. There was not one single person to help them or help any of us. We were all just standing there looking at a machine. There are jobs that could be there and could be done, and we would be a better and more friendly society for it.
Well, Fairfax has uncovered a lot of this, what you could call slave labour, for people on 457, 417 visas being paid way below award rates and in some cases imprisoned in places. I can think of a chicken processing plant where they were housing lots of people in one house and working them like slaves. We had Caltex this week, we've had 7-Eleven, and there's a lot of this going on.
And there's more to be had on that story. We're going to have to wind it up there. John Fowles and Casey Chambers, Anna Patty, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.